Good afternoon and welcome to this special live broadcast from the Linda, WAMC Northeast Public Radio's Performing Arts Studio, where in just a few minutes we'll hear from Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. I'm Alan Chartok. We have a full house with us here at the Linda as we welcome Mr. Bharara, who's making a rare visit to Albany. Today's program is co-sponsored by WAMC and four good government groups, Citizens Union, the New York Public Interest Research Group, Common Cause New York, the League of Women Voters of New York State. The group has also worked with some of this afternoon's questions, which they've handed to me for Mr. Bharara. We'll also begin our program from the representatives of each of these groups. First up is Dare Thompson. Each will be speaking for 1 minute.
Hello, I'm Dare Thompson. The League of Women Voters grew directly out of the women's suffrage movement, which I hope you know, 97 years ago. And our mission was to involve and educate women about government. We quickly realized we should shift to educating all citizens of voting age about their government. We have been watching the culture of corruption in New York State for several decades, and we think there's a direct connection between that culture and how abysmally low our voting turnout is in New York State. We continue to work for limiting money in elections and also in increasing transparency in government, and we hope this will help increase our faith in our government, but we really look forward to the U.S. Attorney's comments. Thank you.
Thank you, dear. Next, we welcome Susan Lerner, Executive Director of Common Cause New York.
Hi, thank you very much, and good afternoon. Common Cause New York is a statewide chapter of Common Cause, the national organization, which is dedicated to restoring the core values of American democracy and reinventing an open, honest, and accountable government that empowers ordinary people to make their voices heard. I want to thank Alan Chartok and WAMC for hosting this important event, but I most particularly want to thank U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara for stepping up to fight longstanding public corruption and shining a light on the need for ethics reform in Albany. We've heard you, Mr. Bharara, and that's why we've proposed a clean conscience pledge to get our state legislature to pass three basic but essential reforms, including closing the LLC loophole. You can find more details about the pledge at ethicspledgeny.org. Thank you.
Now please welcome my favorite person in Albany, Blair Horner, Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group.
Good afternoon. I'd like to start off by thanking WAMC for putting this event together. AMC is an important community resource, and today's event is a perfect example of the role public radio can play in enhancing the public's understanding of whether and how our democracy is functioning. I'd also like to thank the U.S. Attorney, Preet Bharara, and his staff for their extraordinary public service. The scale of the corruption they've identified and rooted out is historic. As a result, this is truly Albany's Watergate moment. New Yorkers must demand a historic Watergate-level response. It's not the role of the U.S. Attorney to reform the laws that allow corruption barely below the surface. That task falls to our elected officials. We must demand that the governor and the state legislature dramatically raise New York's ethical standards. Elected officials are public servants. Somewhere along the way, Albany's insiders lost sight of this. To restore the public's trust, officials must act. Let's hope today's event acts as a spur to that action. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Finally, please welcome Dick Dady, Executive Director of Citizens Union.
Good afternoon. Over the past 18 years, 33 state lawmakers have been forced from office for corruption or misconduct as they worked against the public interest. 16 of them, just under 50%, have been removed or left office in just the past 6 years alone. To respond to this crime wave of corruption, we have passed four different ethics laws over the past 10 years. Most of the changes have, however, have been focused on punishment and enforcement and not necessarily prevention and deterrence. However, we still have not attacked the core problem when state lawmakers use their public posts for private gain. It is why Citizens Union, as a good government organization based in New York City that works to make democracy work for all New Yorkers, believes that we need to attack the issue of compensation head on, raising the salaries of state lawmakers and limiting outside income as a deterrent to the problem of corruption. Into this culture of corruption is a force not connected to the interests of power in Albany, but committed to the public interest, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. His office oversees the investigation and litigation of all criminal and civil cases brought on behalf of the United States in the Southern District of New York, which encompasses the counties of metropolitan New York. His 220 assistant U.S. attorneys handle cases that include narcotics and arms trafficking, terrorism, white-collar crime, public corruption, gang violence, organized crime, and civil rights violations. He has earned a reputation, that of a crusader prosecutor. He's prosecuted nearly 100 Wall Street executives, reached historic agreements with the four largest banks, and closed multi-billion dollar hedge funds. He has brought down many city and state politicians, including, most recently, former Assembly Speaker and the former Senate Majority Leader. Please join me in welcoming the U.S. Attorney, Preet Bharara.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you for having me here. I understand we are being broadcast on the radio. I am going to talk a little bit about public corruption. I have a few things to say. I plan to speak my mind, so I'm glad we're on a 7-second delay. My mom and dad are listening. Sorry, Mom, Dad. So I want to thank WAMC and its president and CEO, Alan Chartok, for inviting me to speak here at the Linda. Of course, I want to thank the good government groups who you just heard from. They're co-sponsoring this event, Citizens Union, Common Cause New York, the League of Women Voters, and the New York Public Interest Group. I want to thank you not only for the invitation to speak here today, but also for the work that you do day in and day out to keep our government and our public officials honest. It is vitally important work. I feel that way because it's important to us and our office. And I also want to say, I appreciate all the kudos and the nice words, and as is my mother who's listening, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say that the work that is done by my office is done in my name, but it's done by the career prosecutors and investigators and FBI agents and other federal law enforcement agents who work really hard and make a lot of sacrifices to do all this good work. I just get to talk about it on their behalf. So you care about an issue that I also feel strongly about and deeply about, corruption and honest government. Before I am a prosecutor, I'm an American, I'm a New Yorker, and I love New York with all my heart. But as most of you know, and as the enthusiastic response to this event in Albany perhaps indicates, what has been going on in New York state government lately is simultaneously heartbreaking, head-scratching, and almost comic. Albany is unquestionably suffering from a crisis of corruption, and that's part of the reason why I'm here talking to all of you, the purpose of my being here. It is to further raise awareness of the problem of corruption, to remind everyone that there are tough cops on the beat, so maybe some people will think twice, to make the case for the importance of good government, to give encouragement to the whistleblowers and agents of change and discouragement to the array of enablers who seem to lurk in this town. And finally, to suggest hope that honest government is not a pipe dream. And to do all that here in Albany, where so much of the responsibility lies and where so much of the solution also resides. The simple fact is that the people in the best position to do something about it work in this town. The general prescription is actually simple. If you want to prevent corruption, don't enable it. If you want to deter corrupt members, don't become their willing accomplices. Now, as you all know, just 2 months ago, both the leader of the New York State Assembly and majority leader of the New York State Senate were on trial at the same time on federal corruption charges in a Manhattan courtroom. And both were convicted by unanimous juries within 13 days of each other. Two of the most powerful people in New York State, two men who held so much of the people's business in their hands, tried and convicted of federal corruption charges. Not to mention the 11 state legislators charged and convicted by my office alone over the last 5 years. And I think you would agree with me, and as has been said by the folks who spoke before I got up here, This moment in history calls for something more than just talk. There's been a lot of talk. It calls for a reexamination of the culture of our public institutions. It calls for all of us, I think, to ask ourselves what we need to do to fix this problem. When a problem gets this bad, it is not just because of those who committed the crimes. It's not just the corrupt actors themselves who bear responsibility. One of the greatest Americans, to my mind, perhaps the greatest American of the 20th century, was Teddy Roosevelt. And he began his brilliant career how? As a New York State Assemblyman at age 23, the youngest in New York history. And he once said this, quote, "No man who is corrupt, no man who condones corruption in others, can possibly do his duty by the community." Close quote. And there has been, sadly, a lot of condoning in Albany. By saying that, by the way, I don't mean to paint all of Albany with a broad brush. I spoke to the mayor of Albany earlier today, and I take her point when she says, why are you always invoking the name? Albany is a wonderful town. It's a wonderful capital of New York State, and I'm glad to spend my day here today. And perhaps it's unfortunate that it's a little bit of a shorthand for talking about some of the people in government in Albany. So I mean Albany, no offense, when I use the shorthand. I think D.C. is also a lovely town, but it sometimes uses the shorthand as well. There are countless honorable and ethical people serving in elected office in the New York State Legislature. People who believe that representing ordinary Americans is a high calling, a calling to improve one's community and one's state and country. I'm here because I have hope that change is possible. I'm here because there are so many good people in the legislature and elsewhere. And I want to congratulate and commend those in government who genuinely embrace reform, advocate change, and welcome scrutiny. And by the way, I have a little bit of a personal perspective on this, which sometimes is lost on the critics. I worked in a legislature as a staff member for 4.5 years. I worked in the United States Senate on the Judiciary Committee, and I am immensely proud of my work serving a legislature. I'm proud of the people I met. I'm proud of the people for whom I served. And I have some understanding, actually, of what it means to serve in a legislative body and how important that work is and how noble that work can be. But that said, in recent times, the New York legislature has been marked by regular bribery, rampant kickbacks, and a rancid culture. Recent events paint a portrait of the show-me-the-money culture in the worst possible way. It continues, by the way, to be a bipartisan affair, Republican and Democrat, in the Assembly and in the Senate, upstate and downstate. And then, of course, there was Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos, a long-serving Assembly Speaker and a long-serving Senate Majority Leader, one a Democrat, the other a Republican, both with a firm grasp and grip on the power in the state of New York, a state of almost 20 million people, and a multi-billion dollar budget. Most of you already know a bit about those two cases, so I just want to make a couple of points before I sit down and take some questions. Both of those cases, by the way, were awful and sad stories. No one says that those two men never did anything good for their community or their state, but they threw it all away by forgetting that their jobs were not meant to be vehicles for massive personal profit, by forgetting that their oaths were not meant to be empty promises of honest service. Along the way, they marginalized, some might say infantilized, their caucuses, who did precious little to challenge that leadership, which turned out to be corrupt leadership. If you attended the trials or reviewed any of the evidence, and I spent a lot of time at both trials, you would have seen how much of an overwhelming sense of entitlement pervaded both leaders' thinking and conduct, entitlement to money, entitlement to power. In fact, the defense in the Sheldon Silver case was basically that this was just business as usual in Albany. As Silver's defense counsel put it, the problem actually was not with Mr. Silver's conduct, but with the prosecutors. The claim was that the prosecutors in my office saw everything through dirty windows. This was just ordinary politics, and we were looking at it the wrong way. His lawyer actually said the following in his opening statement, quote, they, meaning the prosecutors, took conduct which is legal, which is normal, conduct which allows government to function consistent with the way that our founding fathers of the state of New York wanted it to function, and they say this is illegal, close quote. As if the founding fathers, presumably Alexander Hamilton and others, believed in bribery. Well, it turns out, as the trials showed, it wasn't the windows that were dirty. One big problem with the defense, and this is relevant to how people have been talking about this in Albany, is that it maligned every honest fellow legislator. It lumped Sheldon Silver's criminal conduct with the honorable service of upstanding elected officials. And the rest of Albany, those not engaged in criminal quid pro quos, should have been deeply offended by this defense. I'm not sure that they were, but they should have been. I can't make the point any better than one of my prosecutors in my office, Andrew Goldstein, who said during summation the following, quote, in response to all that evidence stacked so powerfully against him, the defense has claimed that Sheldon Silver was just practicing politics as usual. To taint your fellow legislators in the democratic process with your own corruption and say that what happened here is politics as usual, not even close, not by a mile, this is bribery, this is extortion, this is corruption, the real thing, don't let it stand, don't let it stand. And the jury did not. There was a similar sense of hubris and entitlement in the Skelos trial, which I won't recount here. So these cases that we have brought and other prosecutors' offices have brought show, I think, in a very real and powerful way, the deep-rooted problem with corruption in Albany. So what can we do about it? There will always be bad apples. You will find them not just in the legislature. You may find them at a company. You may find them at a hedge fund. You may find them at a university. You may find them in a sports league. The challenge of maintaining an institutional culture is not unique to politics or to political structures. It is the fundamental conundrum and challenge for all institutions since the beginning of time. I mentioned Teddy Roosevelt earlier and his talk about condoning corruption. Let me put it in another way. Among the things that I do in my time as United States attorneys, I talk to students at business schools all the time because we do a lot of white collar work and we do work that affects Wall Street and business people. And when I go and talk to those groups, the bright young business students at some of the best business schools in the country, I say, look, I'm not fully here in the vein of some kind of scared straight program for the white collar folks, although it's a little bit like that. And it's not just to direct my words solely to the two or three of you who, statistically speaking, are likely to commit serious securities fraud in the future, although I know who you are. Rather, my words, and then we follow them, rather, my words are more importantly directed to the ears of the vast majority of people in that room who are good and honest and ethical and who were trying to do the right thing and always want to do the right thing. I tell them to speak up if they see misconduct, to promote a culture of ethics and integrity, and not to have tolerance for corruption, because that's the challenge for every institution. Every famous case that you might have read about out of my office involving an institution that our office or other offices handle shows the same pattern. And the pattern is people knew. People knew before the prosecutor showed up, before the FBI showed up. People always know. You think no one knew Sheldon Silver was corrupt before he was put in handcuffs? Not a chance. Whether you're talking about Bernard Madoff's firm, or the Galleon Group, a corrupt hedge fund, or with a scandal like the abuse at Penn State, good people knew, and yet they didn't do anything. A lot of pain and suffering and loss of reputation could have been saved in each and every one of those cases if the good people had just done something. If the good people had just sounded the alarm. That is also the problem, in my view, with corruption in Albany. There was a deafening silence of the individuals who, over the time period covered by our investigations, must have seen something, must have known something, but said nothing. Those who learned of suspicious and potentially criminal activity in the halls of the Capitol yet said nothing. No one made a call. No one blew the whistle. No one sounded the alarm. That's part of the problem that I've been speaking about, the utter failure to self-police in the Capitol. I mean, among other things, you have an ethics committee not allowed to review ethics bills. You have a body that many times talks about how it doesn't like scrutiny. What is that? It's a public institution. It's the people's house. Scrutiny is part of the ballgame. Now, to be sure, as I said a few minutes ago, there are absolutely brave and vocal souls in the legislature who have been inveighing against corruption, who have been welcoming scrutiny, who have been advocating reforms. But they have been too few, and there need to be more of them. When the charges were first brought against Hilton Silver, there was an interesting mix of reactions from the legislature, which I think is symptomatic of the problem I'm talking about, the enabling problem I'm talking about. And I hope and trust it's better 1 year on, but I just want to remind everyone about it. Many seem to be in denial about the corruption problem. Some dismissed the seriousness of the problem. And yet others, by the way, denigrated the prosecutors in my office who were just doing their jobs. For some time, even after Mr. Silver was charged in a very detailed 35-page complaint, approved by a federal judge and establishing probable cause that he had committed federal crimes, there was a movement by some of your legislators to maintain him in his leadership position in the assembly. It was quite an enlightening, if not enlightened, moment. Let me be clear, there is, of course, an absolute presumption of innocence. That's the foundation of our criminal justice system, and it always has to be that way, and that's why we have the finest criminal justice system, even though flawed, in the world. But the presumption of innocence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that's a criminal standard. It is not the standard for trusted leadership in the most important positions in our government. I would think and would hope the standard to maintain one of the most powerful public positions in our state is something higher than, I have not yet been convicted of a crime. How many of you are allowed such a luxury in your jobs? I bet not one of you. Just think about how this looked to the rest of the world and the rest of the people in New York when, if you were a police officer or a precinct commander or the principal of a school or a firefighter, and you had laid at your feet a 35-page detailed complaint approved for probable cause by a federal judge, brought by an office with a close to 100% conviction rate, do you think that that person would or should maintain his leadership position in any institution that values integrity, that cares about not enabling corruption, that doesn't have massive tolerance for bad conduct? No, those people, those ordinary public servants, some of which I just mentioned as examples, would have been on desk duty or the rubber room that very day. And if they weren't, interestingly, I bet some of the politicians who were supportive with respect to their leader would have been the first ones clamoring for them to lose their position of leadership until the trial concluded. So it tells you something. It tells you a lot of something about the culture of an institution, and that something is not good. Now, to be fair, that didn't last a long time. And a few days later, he was removed from his leadership position. And I have no business telling the legislature how to do their work in connection with their leadership. I'm making a point about what that says about the enabling culture from our experience doing these cases. Not only, by the way, was there talk of keeping Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos in their positions of leadership even after serious criminal charges were brought, there was also a lot of dismissive talk and denigration of the prosecutors who brought the cases. There were some legislators who spent more time in whispered whining about the prosecutors than in acknowledging and solving the problem that brought us to this point in the first place. They said we did not understand politics, that we didn't like politics, which was, of course, nonsense. It's not politics that public corruption prosecutors don't like, but corrupt politics, criminal politics. And you know who else doesn't like it? The people who put the politicians in their jobs. Just a quick final Teddy Roosevelt story, not to be obsessed with Teddy Roosevelt. You know, he was a person who was elected to the State Assembly in 1882 at the age of 23, youngest ever in history, as I said. And that was a time of a lot of corruption in New York. And there was this thing called Tammany Hall. And Tammany Hall had a lot of sway in the city, but it also had sway over legislators in the Capitol as well. And as the story goes, and it's been confirmed by multiple sources, Tammany Hall did not care much for this reformer young freshman named Teddy Roosevelt, and they also underestimated him as small and weak, and as often happened in those days, and still happens in some form now, intimidation tactics were attempted to be used so that this young person would go along and get along in the way that they expected people to do so. And the story goes that a gentleman by the name of Big John McManus, who was in the legislature, was going to involve himself in a prank that they sometimes did to get young assembly people in line, which was to wrap him in a rug and sort of pull this prank on him. But in part, as an appendage of Tammany Hall and all of the corruption that that entailed. And as the story goes, John McManus approached Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt, 23, exclaimed, "By God, McManus, I hear you're going to toss me in a blanket. By God, if you try anything like that, I'll kick you, I'll bite you, I'll kick you in the balls." Thank goodness for the seven-second delay. Yeah. "I'll do anything to you. You better leave me alone." And they did. Now, I'm not saying that young legislators are still being thrown in blankets or in rugs. And I'm not saying that physical violence is being threatened. But it tells you something about the character of Teddy Roosevelt and how a culture can form based on the particular people who are addressing it. And it would be nice to see a little more of that fight back in some of our legislatures, some of our legislators today. At the end of the day, cleaning up public corruption, preventing public corruption, is not up to prosecutors. We certainly have our role to prosecute the wrongdoers and the bad apples, but we can't do it alone. We can never do it alone. It will take leadership, leadership from the legislature itself. And that's what people crave. They crave leadership. But looking the other way is not leadership. Blaming the prosecutors is not leadership. Kicking the can is not leadership. Accepting lies and half-truths is not leadership. Making excuses is not leadership. Whining is not leadership. Hopefully, for all of our sakes, we will see real leadership from our public institutions, because it matters. Because the institution that polices itself, that cares about policing itself, is the institution that gets and deserves respect. That is the institution that garners trust. That is the institution that attracts talent. That is the institution that rallies public support. That is the institution that gets things done for the people. That is the institution that the people of New York deserve. It is noble work to represent ordinary Americans, and people should act like it a little bit more. Thank you for inviting me. I'm going to sit down and take some questions now.
So, Mr. Bharara, I have a question for you.
I hope you have several.
And it is the same. It is the same question. The same thing we say here in radio. And it, you once said the two most famous words in Albany, which were "Stay tuned." You said "Stay tuned."
And I didn't invent that phrase, by the way. They use it on TV. Batman.
Exactly. Stay tuned. So, are we still staying tuned?
You should always stay tuned, at least for the next 32 minutes.
Can we expect more of the same?
Look, as I've said a number of times before, we have a lot of prosecutors in our public corruption unit. We have investigators who support them. We have FBI agents who work along their side. And we're not closing up shop anytime soon.
So there was...
That's not explicit enough?
Yeah, it's explicit. Pretty explicit.
I would write it out, but we're on radio.
Do you have any interest in public office yourself?
So let me put it this way. Given that Bruce Springsteen is in town, I was not born to run.
Oh. There are people who say, well, you know, this is the last year that you have because there'll be a new president, and then the new president appoints the U.S. attorney. But we know better.
The new president could like me, too.
Well, most of us who taught political science a long time ago know that the senior senator of the same party gets to pick the U.S. attorney for the most part. So I'm assuming if a Democrat wins, you could be here for 8 years if you wanted to be.
Why don't we wait and see what happens? You can invite me back.
Okay. Well, once a year, okay. So how long do you want to stay in this position?
I think it's the best job that I've ever had. It's the best job I will ever have. I think the only thing I ever wanted to be when I went to law school was to be an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. And people don't get this, but the job of a prosecutor is not to stock up convictions and notch victories in his or her belt. It's to do the right thing. It's to do justice. It's to make sure that you bring cases that are righteous and you walk away from cases that are righteous to walk away from also. And there's very few people, especially in the law, whose job it is to wake up every day and think, how can I make the world a little bit better, a little bit safer? And if I ever don't believe deep in my mind and in my heart and in my gut in a case that we're pursuing, then we don't pursue it. And that's a nice way to go to sleep every night. So why would anybody want to leave a job like that?
You mentioned your folks listening right now. And you're a man of tremendous courage. You won't say that, I will. But you're a man of tremendous courage. So
my folks wouldn't say that.
So how much did they give you that allowed you to be who you are today?
Wow, you're making them really happy right now. Mm-hmm. You know, my brother and I like to say and believe that they made us who we are from beginning to end. My father and my mother were born in India. I was born in India. My father's the first person in his entire family, one of 13. My mother's one of 7. Very busy family. My dad was the first person to go to college in his whole family. He went to medical school and came to America hoping for a better life, like so many people did for me and my brother. And the reason he was able to get to where he got was because he worked hard and he understood the value of education. So the most important thing in our house when we were growing up was to work hard, study hard. And again, this is a common story for lots of people, immigrants and otherwise. That's how you get to be where you are. And so my brother and I think about that every day. We would be nowhere without them.
So what's your favorite Springsteen song?
So, you know, people ask me that sometimes, and I want to pick a more obscure one, but it's Thunder Road. Thunder Road is the best Springsteen song.
There you go. Did you come and spend this whole day in Albany because of Springsteen?
I came to be with you, Alan.
That's great. Okay, so the old adage is...
Why are you selling yourself so short?
Short? Okay, so... The old adage is follow the money. In state government, that would lead us to different places. Now, up in Buffalo, you're looking at something called, the Buffalo Billions and how contracts were awarded. What do you have to tell us about that?
I have nothing to say about it. I don't talk about things that we're looking at or not looking at until we're done.
Okay. Let me ask you about this. We know that in the case of Skelos, we know that in the case of Silver, they were personally enriching themselves or their relatives. But there's this other whole area where people collect $16 million for a campaign fund, and obviously nobody gives you money unless they want something back for it. Is that something that interests you?
Look, everything interests me. I have wide-ranging curiosity. But, we're a criminal prosecutor's office, and we can only bring cases that the law allows us to bring. And, you know, famously, people have said that this, the scandal, I'm sure you hear this a lot in Albany, the scandal is not what's illegal, it's what's legal. And, the folks sitting to my right from the good government groups probably have a lot more relevant things to say about campaign finance. But if people follow the rules and give money in the way they're allowed to give money, then there's nothing that my office can do about that. That's up to other folks.
But, of course, if you find out that somebody gave money specifically with a promise to get something back for it, that would be different.
It's a higher burden to prove that a contribution, an otherwise lawful contribution, was given specifically for a particular official action. You have to prove that. That's often a difficult thing to prove.
Well, you have been pretty successful at expanding, what people assumed could be done, the concept of taking a law and expanding it.
Well, I don't think we've expanded any law. We've used the law as written, and maybe there have been folks who have not been as industrious and hardworking at connecting the dots or following the money as the brilliant, hardworking prosecutors who work in my office, but we didn't expand one thing. We took the law as it came to us. The law required us to prove quid pro quo, and we proved it. Now, in the Silver case and the Scales case, just because you dress up a bribe or dress up a kickback as a legal referral fee, doesn't make it so. And we proved that that's what those were. And two juries, unanimously of 12, found that quickly in rapid succession.
Do you think that was because people are just sick to death of the political
culture? No, I don't think so at all. There was one commentator who suggested that, and I said about that commentator that he wasn't in the courtroom, he didn't listen to the evidence, he didn't deliberate, he didn't bother to maybe even read the charging instrument. The summations in both of those cases were very powerful because the evidence was very powerful. And, one thing that I hope people understand is when we bring the cases, we bring cases that we think are, where people have galloped over. We're not trying to criminalize politics. When we're not trying to change what the rules are, we're saying if you are taking bribes and kickbacks in exchange for official action, for example, in the case of Dean Skelos, repeatedly engaging in official action or threatening the withholding of favorable official action so that his son could get a no-show job, well, that's a crime. That's always been a crime, and we'll prosecute it as such. And what people also don't appreciate is there was a lot of evidence in both of those trials that showed what was in the minds of the people who were being prosecuted. We were up on court-authorized wiretaps of some phones being used by Dean Skelos and his son. And if you go back and recount the evidence, there's clear evidence that they knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing was wrong. There was the one phone call in which Adam Skelos was talking to, and this was played at trial, so it's all publicly available information. In connection with a court-authorized wiretap call where Adam Skelos, at a time when he and his father became concerned that there was some scrutiny on the part of federal officials and out of my office, that it was hard to talk on the phone. And he calls up his father, and he expresses his frustration about not being able to talk on the phone freely about their thing. And he says, I believe, it's very frustrating. It's like effing Preet Bharara is listening to every effing phone call. Like that one.
We have a lot of DAs. We have a lot of DAs, good ones, who do on the state level. We have an attorney general. Why does it take the federal government to do this?
Well, I think they are great DAs. I'm friends with many of the DAs in my district and in other districts. I just spoke at the New York State District Attorney Association conference in New York a few weeks ago, and I think they have brought good public corruption prosecutions and others. I can only speak for what my office does, and I think that historically, long before I got there and long after I leave, that we have the best, most enterprising, aggressive prosecutors around who work with the best, most enterprising federal agents around.
So, I don't know.
Are we done?
No. Stay right there. The CNO poll said 89% of New Yorkers think corruption is a serious problem. So now that you've done the work you've done, should they feel better?
They shouldn't feel worse. Look, how often is it the case that 89% of the public agrees on anything like that, on any issue? I believe that same poll also said only 4% of New Yorkers thought that my office has gone too far, which is an I think more people think that the earth is flat. It's an astonishing consensus. And I hope that over time, people feel better about it. I mean, there was some criticism somewhere that I read suggesting, well, with Bharara's office bringing all these cases, it's making the state legislature in Albany look bad. To which my response was, what's making the state legislature in Albany look bad is the state legislature in Albany. I mean, the same thing was said about insider trading prosecutions that we brought. And what you hope is over time, the people can rebound in their faith a little bit because they think that there are cops on the beat, that it's not a one-off thing, that it's a sustained effort, and that over time, better people are drawn into the process. The bad people leave the process, either in handcuffs or otherwise, and people get hope again that you can have a culture in your government, whether it's in Washington or in Albany or anywhere else, that people can be proud of. And there are really, I want to repeat again, because I know with the newspaper reports, are all going to print the bad things that I said. There are really good people in the legislature, and you hear their voices. By the way, you hear their voices more, I think, recently in the last year, as I think more and more people have learned it's okay to speak about these kinds of things. It's okay to be defiant about these things, not necessarily in the way that Teddy Roosevelt was, but it's okay to do that. And I think over time, if you remove the worst miscreants from the legislature, you encourage the people who want to make things better in the legislature, you give voice to the people like these fine folks to my right in good government groups, that the net result of all of those things happening together is people can feel much, much better about their government. That's my hope, at least.
So how do you incentivize the legislature to do what they don't think may be in their own immediate interest?
Well, I have a particularly blunt incentive.
That's been around for a while.
And that's the avoidance of prison. But for other people, I think, you know, look, if people are thinking about their institution in a way that hopefully they were thinking about it when they ran for the positions, and they're thinking about the respect of the institution, then hopefully that incentivizes them. Because the better the quality of the person who is running for the position, the more likely he or she is going to be to want to do the right thing by the public. I also think that there can be, you know, a decent amount of, or a better amount of, self-policing at that level to incentivize people. And hopefully over time, people want, you know, like everyone else here, people want to work in a place that folks are proud of. And people come to work in my office not for the money. They could all make more money elsewhere. These are the top law students in the country come into my office. And they leave literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on the table. And they come to work there because they're really proud of the place. And they're proud of the way they get to serve the public. And so we attract not just bright minds, but good people. And I think every government institution can aspire to that, whether it's the United States Senate, or it's a U.S. Attorney's Office, it's a public school, or it's a legislature. And you want to make sure that people are saying that kind of thing over and over and over again, as opposed to, these are trumped up charges, he should remain in power. Like that's not the culture you want.
So how do you, what are the mechanisms that gets an ethics committee that won't meet, and when they finally get a chair who wants to actually, is embarrassed and wants to bring a bill, is told, okay, you're not going to be the chair anymore, we're moving you to another committee. I mean, how do you deal with that?
You know, I'm not in the legislature, so, you know, I know how to prosecute a case. I don't know how to do that. So you have to ask those folks. But I think sometimes you just have to do it. And when something happens to you because you try to do what you think your job is, you can quit or you can make a stink about it, right? You can exit or you can use your voice. And I think more people will start to do that over time. I mean, there's a lot of attention that's been paid to this simple fact. I don't know if it'll lead to anything in terms of having hearings. But again, I don't mention that because it's a panacea and that's all of a sudden going to miraculously fix ethics in the legislature. It's just an example of a thing that seems bizarre, particularly to someone who worked in a legislature. You know, that's not how you think legislatures operate. You have committees for a reason. You distribute power among people who have been elected for a reason. Obviously, institutions have hierarchies. My institution, I mean, I'm the boss of my institution, and I quite enjoy that. but it doesn't mean that nobody else has any, and nobody else has any persuasive ability. It doesn't mean I don't listen to people. I think people just have to abandon that way of thinking about their jobs.
There's something called the iron law of oligarchy. You get a lot of people sitting in a room. Sooner or later, one person, I don't want to say one guy, but one person ends up running it all. How do you stop that from happening? because, you know, somebody wants
to... You're asking me increasingly complex questions about...
Yeah, well, it's not my fault. This is all coming from the, you know, from the good government groups. It's not my fault.
Look, I mean, what you do is, I think, and maybe this sounds idealistic, but I think a little bit of idealism would be good for a change here, is you have to make sure that everybody at the institution has an independent operating mind and brain and gut, so that at least somebody, when in the face of overreaching or in the face of despotism or in the face of corruption, will say and rally people, you know, to the opposite side and say, this is enough. We can't tolerate this. We can't go along with this. And you have lots of institutions. You have lots of bad things that have happened in human history, much worse than the kinds of corruption that we're talking about here, because you didn't have that countervailing force, because people didn't stand up, because people didn't have the courage. Maybe they weren't taught it. Maybe they didn't have it to begin with. But part of the reason that I say these things to business students and young people in particular is you want them to remember when they go to a place and they see bad things happening, that they do. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's obviously really, really hard to be a whistleblower or to go against the tide. Look, there was evidence at our trial, very sad, about, and you alluded to it earlier in a question, about what happened to people who dared to challenge the leadership. Well, look what happens to the institution overall when people year after year after year learn the lesson of challenging power in an appropriate way is oblivion. Well, over time, if enough people stand up to that, then it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, you're a student of all of this, Preparar. Tell me this. Should we change? There's a big call now for a constitutional convention, you know, to change the ethics laws and change the way that we do things. Based on your reading of the Constitution, what you had to do to bring your cases and everything else, do you think we should have such a thing?
That's up to the people of New York to decide. I understand that it's a difficult set of obstacles and hoops to get through to have a state constitutional convention. But generally speaking, I think it's not a terrible idea. If people can reopen and relitigate some things, because there's some things structurally, perhaps in the Constitution, that don't make a lot of sense. One of which I'm told is that it's difficult to change the law with respect to whether or not an elected official can maintain his or her pension even after being convicted of public corruption crimes lasting years and years. If that's a constitutional matter, I think it's not a stretch to say that might be an interesting thing to change and fix. But beyond that, I think it's up to other people to decide. I don't know it well enough to understand what all the other upsides or downsides would be.
Well, personally, I'm a little concerned, not that you care, but
I care deeply.
Yes. I'm a little concerned that the politicians who get themselves elected to the legislature also have a cousin Louis who they'll get elected to the Constitutional Convention.
That may be. I haven't investigated the cousin Louis situation.
I love it. Okay. So now, do you believe in structural changes like the amount of years that a legislator should be allowed to serve?
Look, I'm a prosecutor. I say more than some prosecutors. I may have a personal view on some of those things, but I don't have all the facts. I don't serve in the legislature. I don't serve on a committee that is making recommendations as to what kinds of changes should be made that would lessen corruption. I don't presume to know that. When it was my job, when I did serve in the legislature, I presumed to know it, even if I was going to get it wrong. But I think there are a lot of things for people to consider. And my role in talking about this stuff is simply to point out our experiences and to show, based on evidence that we have seen and the trials that we have undertaken, what some of the hardships are in being able to prove things, what some of the hardships are in being able to ferret out the good behavior from the bad behavior, and some of our sense of why it was easier or less easy for certain people to commit crimes. And so when you talk about, as a matter of common sense and based on our experience, a intense concentration of power over a long period of time, and we didn't need our prosecutions to know this, to know that is more likely to give rise to a situation in which, and an atmosphere in which, the people who have aggrandize all the power to themselves and kept it for a very, very long time are more likely to commit crime and to get away with it. That's, you know, standard operating human procedure. But it's just borne out in the cases that we have talked about. And there are legislators in many contexts who serve admirably and honorably for decades. And I understand the argument. I'm not giving you a cookie-cutter answer. I understand the argument that, well, why should constituents be robbed of expertise and clout in Albany or in Washington if their representative is honorable and hardworking and great? And that's a decent argument. There's also an argument to suggest that that's the exception rather than the norm. And overall, for overall justice and for an overall good, you know, political system, that is most likely to cause the most amount of justice for the most amount of people across a city or a state or a country, that you have to enact those limits. That's a reasonable argument too. I mean, I would have to look at all those things and consider them. I just think that what we have to offer through the evidence and facts relating to our cases should be part of that debate and part of that discussion among the people who are actually the ones who have some say about it.
The always brilliant newspapers and pundits have said again and again that you were looking at Governor Cuomo during all of this time. And one of the things that you were particularly furious about the Moreland Act Commission.
I don't get furious. Do I seem furious?
Yes. And I'm getting out of here. The dropping of the Moreland Act Commission was a disgrace. And you picked up the pieces and you went and you looked at all of that. And then finally you said, and this is a little problem between the Albany Times Union, which said one thing and which we've been told, which was that, that there wasn't enough evidence to indict the governor. That's the quote that we were treated to. And then I read the ATU this weekend and said there was no evidence. Could you set us straight on that?
I don't have my statement in front of me. I could recite it to you, but I wouldn't say anything beyond what I said in the statement that we released a couple of weeks ago.
And so you're sticking with that?
Believe me, I'm sticking with the statement that I made, yes.
Yeah, but they're just so for my limited capacity to absorb, that there wasn't enough evidence.
I believe the phrase we used, I have folks in the back, was there was insufficient evidence.
Insufficient evidence, okay. What role does the governor have in fighting corruption?
I think everybody has a role. The people in the audience have a role. The good government groups have a role. The legislators have a role. In some way, prosecutors have a role in bringing the cases they bring and educating the public and increasing awareness in an appropriate way. But anybody who is in a position to consider the factors and consider the evidence and who is based on his or her position to enact reforms that might make things better, I think has a special responsibility. And that includes anyone in our government who has the ability to propose legislation, pass legislation, modify legislation. I think everyone has a strong responsibility in that regard.
Now, one thing that has been suggested for making the legislature more honest is to raise their pay. And I'm wondering whether you have a view on whether or not that's...
I'm going to disappoint you again. It's reasonable. It's not crazy for people to suggest that you take away the possibility of outside income a little bit because of what our cases showed, that if you have this unlimited ability to have outside income, you can hide bribes and kickbacks more easily. On the other hand, it's also reasonable for people to say, why don't they earn the money that they're getting paid now? I think it all depends on overall what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, at some point, if public corruption becomes such a problem that people care about more than other things, then that's how you decide how to make your trade-off, right? That is it worth paying them a little bit extra to take away this temptation to make so much extra that they're compromising their decisions about the things that affect all of your lives? I don't know that we're there in New York, but we could be there in New York.
Interesting.
Was that an appropriately circuitous answer to your question?
So if you were me, what question would you ask next?
um, You could go back to asking me how much I love my job. I don't know. I trust you to ask the questions.
Okay. So the media. Let me ask you very quickly. Are we doing our jobs?
A lot of you are. So there's a problem with the media, which I say often has a role to play. You know, the politicians themselves have a role to play in self-policing. Prosecutors have a role to play in getting rid of the bad apples as appropriate. The public has a role to play because they choose who to elect. They can choose to have a constitutional convention if they want or not. And the press. Now, the best use to me, given what I do at the moment, is investigative journalism. And there are cases that we have brought in the public corruption realm and otherwise. And I hope people appreciate this. Literally get started because we open up a newspaper. And there's a great columnist at some paper or investigative journalist who writes, there's this bad stuff happening over here, and it seems credible, we open an investigation. And that's a remarkable thing. You know, a free and open press can almost do as much, or maybe in some cases more, depending on the circumstances, than any prosecutor can do to shine a light on things. And part of what we care about, it's not just holding people accountable, which is important, but exposing the truth. You know, journalists and prosecutors and investigators share a number of interests, and one of those interests is the truth. I'm happy, for example, that in some ways, this might sound an odd formulation of it, but you'll understand what I mean, that Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos went to trial, and they didn't plead guilty. So everybody could see all the evidence that we had, and everybody could see how the system was betrayed, and everybody could see how the oaths were violated. And that's an important thing. And so when folks in the press take a gander at some problem, public mischief especially, that's a great service to a lot of people on its own, because sometimes if people have some shame and self-respect, they may alter the process, they may alter their practices. The side benefit is sometimes it opens up a criminal investigation for us. My worry is, and I've said this before, my worry is that the state of journalism being what it is and the impossibility of turning a profit based on old journalism especially affects, as far as I can tell, especially affects investigative journalism generally, because that's a very expensive proposition. It takes a lot of investment. And even more importantly, affects sort of small-town investigative journalism. I don't think you have as much of a problem in New York City where there's a million reporters. But there are a lot of places throughout New York State and the rest of the country where paper after paper closes down, or an investigative unit that had six people and could look at whether or not, you know, the local plants were, you know, giving us good water, or whether there was lead poisoning here or there, all these bad things that happen, often the people who are sounding the alarm bell first are the journalists. But as the industry and the economics of journalism change, I worry about that.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave the discussion because we are out of time. I would like to thank our co-sponsors for today's event, Citizens Union, the New York Public Interest Research Group, Common Cause New York, the League of Women Voters of New York State. Thanks to all of you for filling the Linda and WAMC Northeast Public Radio's Performing Arts Studio for this event. All the seats were claimed in less than one day. Most of all, let's thank Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for Southern District of New York. I'm Alan Sharkar.
Thank you, Alan.